quote of the day: the wise man does not lay up his own treasures. The more he gives to others, the more he has for his own. Lao Tzu. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of Crazy Money. This is your host, Paul. Hope you're doing great today. It is a wonderful day to be alive, and there's no more appropriate way to remember that than thinking about the role of generosity in our lives, the generosity that we as individuals have the power to share with the world. My guest today and our jungle guide through the world of generosity is Chris Anderson. You know him as the head or the chief curator of TED, the massively globally popular platform for online talks. He is the author of a new book called Infectious Generosity, The Ultimate Idea Worth Spreading. I was very excited to get to speak to Chris because he's such an interesting human being and he is so well connected in the world. But I did get kind of short notice. So I made the mistake. I was so intent on finishing his book and having good questions to ask him about his new philosophy that I neglected to read his Wikipedia page and learn more about him as a person. And he's got a fascinating background. Chris's father was an eye surgeon, an evangelical Christian who ran a mobile hospital in rural Pakistan, where Chris was born in 1957. He attended school in the Himalayan mountains of India before transferring to a boarding school near Bath, England. He attended university at Oxford, where he studied philosophy, politics, and economics. In the mid-1980s, Chris was fascinated with the personal computer revolution and founded a publishing company, Future Publishing, that created specialized computer publications and eventually grew to publish over 150 magazines and websites, employing over 2,000 people. But Chris wanted to contribute more to the world. Using the proceeds of his success, Chris established a foundation to tackle tough global issues through media, technology, entrepreneurship, and ideas. In 2001, that foundation acquired the TED Conference, then an annual meeting of luminaries in the field of technology, entertainment, and design held in Monterey, California. Chris left the publishing world to work full-time on TED, and in the next two decades, TED expanded to include the TED Prize, TED Ed, and the licensing of its brand, that is, the free distribution, the generous free distribution of its platform via the TEDx local independently produced conferences around the globe. In his new book, Infectious Generosity, Chris argues that now more than ever, the world needs us to activate and accelerate our natural inclination toward helping our fellow human, if only for our own benefit. He speaks not just of financial generosity, though that's certainly a huge opportunity, but also of creative generosity and of generosity of spirit. In this conversation, Chris and I discuss how generosity has the power to create positive change and spark generosity in others. We talk about how to figure out if you or I are a net giver or net taker in life. It's kind of a scary proposition, right? The role media can play in spreading generosity. We talk about performative philanthropy that we see in the likes of Mr. Beast and others on social media platforms. And we talk about the contribution TED has made to the world by providing the platform for sharing valuable ideas. Before we get to the conversation, folks, I want to update you on Team Olinger's move to New York City that I mentioned a few weeks back. Yes, it is indeed happening. The kids got into school. Our Atlanta house is under contract, and we are in due diligence on a place on the Upper West Side. It is kind of scary and at the same time, incredibly exciting to be making this move. And many people have asked me, why would you do this? Why at 55 would you pick up and run back into the burning building that the news tells us New York City is? Well, I was in New York City last week looking for places to live, and it didn't quite feel like a burning building. It felt quite exciting to be walking those streets again. But why are we making this move? Well, here's an example. After Chris and I finished our conversation, I turned off the recording, and we continued to chat, and he said how pleasantly surprised he was with the scope of our discussion, that it wasn't just conversation about money, as is implied by the title of the podcast, Crazy Money, which, side note, again, is an argument for changing the name to something more descriptive and broader. But then he said something that was really lovely. He said, I'd love to have coffee with you sometime. I was like, well, as it happens, I'll be in New York City, where he lives, as of this summer, and I look forward to sitting down and visiting with you in person. In the same way I'll get to do with AJ Jacobs and Bruce Feiler and other fun, crazy money guests that I've had on that I haven't had a chance to meet in person, So that's kind of one reason to move to New York. There's just a lot of very fascinating people who live in New York. And while Atlanta will always be my hometown, and we'll be leaving a big part of our hearts there, at 55 years old, I still have work to do, and I am just giddy and excited about the possibilities and adventures awaiting us in New York City, and look forward to sharing those experiences with you on this podcast, whatever the hell we're going to call it, a couple months down the line. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Chris Anderson.
I was reading on your Twitter bio, you said most days you're an optimist. How's today going?
Well, you kind of have to define optimism, right? It's not a feeling. It's a determination to look for a pathway that is hopeful.
I would think that a guy that would write a book calling for a worldwide movement of generosity is mostly an optimist.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're looking to create the conditions for optimism, right? I just think the future isn't written yet. And how it turns out to be depends on what a critical mass of people choose to make it.
What are those conditions for optimism?
I think that it's a judgment. We're in a world that's very challenging right now. There's a lot of trends that are pushing us in a difficult direction. And to be optimistic about the future, you have to believe that humans are capable of responding to what we're seeing and taking actions that make things better. One of the things I've been most worried about is the escalating division in our culture, which I think is pretty toxic, pretty dangerous. We have always had this superpower of being able to look at problems and kind of figure out the smart way forward and address them. And we're in danger of throwing that away because we're not listening to each other. We're not kind of willing even to associate with each other often. And so the hard stuff is going to be left unresolved, and that's not good. So that's really a lot of the motivation for writing the book, is to try and find ways of spreading a different way of thinking. I mean, generosity really, it starts with generosity of intent, of mindset. Are you willing to assume good intent from someone else, at least for a moment, and hear them out? We've stopped doing that, and it's extremely dangerous.
Now, I try to be self-aware as a middle-aged man. To what extent the problems I see in the world are there because I'm a middle-aged man who starts to notice the world around him and screams, "Get off my lawn," and to what extent are they unique to our times? Can you parse that for me?
Look, by many measures, the world is unbelievably better than it has ever been. Like, unbelievably. There is no time in history I would rather have been born than in the modern era. I think the reason to be worried right now is two reasons. One is just that the astonishing acceleration of technology to the point where all bets are off as to where it goes. I'm thinking of artificial intelligence especially. Like, we are building something that is going to be more powerful than we are. We're doing it kind of willingly, although I'm not sure anyone was ever asked to vote on it. But there is a commercial dynamic and a sort of tech excitement dynamic that is driving this innovation. And AI is, every week, there is another breathtaking advance. And it's just anyone who looks at what we are building and looks at the world as it currently is arranged is going to conclude that every single job is going to be impacted. Every way that we currently have of doing things is going to be impacted in short order. Are we ready for this? We've already seen how technology can have horrible unintended consequences. I'm thinking especially of social media. That is a legitimate cause for concern, even among people who fundamentally believe that technology has over time made the world better. I believe that. But the acceleration of power of these technologies, it just means that it's more and more the case that any individual or any moment can spark ripples of unimaginable impact because of the power of what we're creating. And then the second piece, as I alluded to, is that we are divided right now. And there are things in our culture that are making us more divided, which makes it harder to step back and use our ingenuity to actually imagine a good way forward.
Well, let's talk about specifically about the book, and we'll come back to some of these themes because they're interwoven, certainly. The title of the book is Infectious Generosity, The Ultimate Idea Worth Spreading, of course, making reference to Ted's motto, Ideas Worth Spreading. Talk to me about generosity and how you see it as the the key to a lot of the problems we have in the world and making things better.
Right. So we evolved. We were this ape that came off the savannah and started doing things that were kind of amazing. And the reason we were able to do things that were amazing, like, I don't know, build a civilization, build a city even, was because we figured out ways to cooperate with each other. Now, this didn't all just come from generosity and people feeling lovey-dovey towards each other. Not at all. A lot of the dynamic is driven by people trading with each other, embracing, you know, the power of markets. Markets are a miracle. Capitalism has its many problems, but basically it has had a miraculous effect on human development. It's been the ultimate spreader of powerful ideas and innovations across the planet. And other innovations like the rule of law and like finding ways in which societies can be organized so that people, you know, can wake up in the morning and basically feel safe and feel like they can dream a dream and build something. Those have all been crucial. But all of our systems have been flawed and they have all needed tweaking, changing, improving. And a lot of those changes have come from public-spirited individuals being willing to work for the greater good and to do things on behalf of others. And indeed, under the surface, so much of what makes society tick over comes from people basically being willing to trust each other. You know, you can't really have trading systems without a level of trust being somewhere in the mix there. And so I don't think we would have achieved anything of what we've built without this strange, deep instinct to want to work for each other. It's inside everyone, but it's a kind of crude instinct, and it needs sharpening. It needs turning from an instinct into an idea that says, let's be thoughtful about this. You want to help someone else? Have you pondered how and why to do that? Does it just have to be someone in your in-group? Could it be someone broader than that? All these questions are part of the sharpening of generosity, the turning of it from a feeling into a more powerful idea. Every religion has at its heart an attempt to turn the instinct into compassion in some form and the willingness to work for others, to love thy neighbor, as it were. I think it's a nuanced story, but I do think ultimately all that we have achieved has only been possible because of generosity. And I think that we're in dire danger right now of throwing it away. A lot of the world has stepped back from religion, and I have myself. And I think there's a lot of good reasons for that. We haven't massaged that instinct the way that religions did. You can make a case that the world is getting meaner and that that is terribly dangerous.
Because we're not going to Sunday Mass or to temple or to mosque as frequently as large a percentages as we once were, the instinct, the reminder, the daily affirmation, if you will, to say, I should be thinking of other people, isn't as ingrained in our secular society, especially one that is connected by these things and these devices, which encourage us to look inward as opposed to looking outward.
Yeah, exactly. That is a problem. The philosopher Alain de Botton gave a TED talk that I have not been able to get out of my head called Atheism 2.0. Yeah. He says, he's an atheist.
Right.
He says, look, we are embarking on a very reckless social experiment here where we are abandoning the practice of centuries of human civilization of gathering people weekly and reminding them humans are pretty fragile. And you know, we don't just easily do what's right. We need all manner of, call them life hacks, reminders, encouragements to each other. We need to figure out lots of ways to remind ourselves that there is a merit in not just living for ourselves. One of the big benefits is actually that it makes us weirdly happy to do things for other people. We've kind of forgotten that bit of wisdom to an extent. That's a terrible piece of wisdom to forget, because we need all the help we can get to nudge ourselves into being our better selves, I would say.
I was just looking at my shelf because I have that book in one of my bookshelves. I believe it's called Religion for Atheists by Alain de Botton. And it's not just that it's the weekly reminder to do good things for other people. It's also the gathering together of people where we need that communal interaction. We need to be together, as pandemic taught us, is that community is really important.
Absolutely. We are not individuals. We are a social species. And so much of our effectiveness, our life experience, our sense of meaning, definitely our happiness. And it comes from these interwoven relationships. And so absolutely, we need to meet, we need to convene. And different things happen when you convene as a family or as a local community or in a throng of people singing together. That is a weird biological phenomenon where people's minds meld in a really amazing way and they feel part of one bigger thing. It's a terrible thing to let all of that go, I think.
Let's talk about that evolved social instinct that Peter Singer calls enlightened self-interest, that we really do have not just an instinct, but a need to do favors, to be generous with others. Have we lost that? Is that something that our society has de-evolved us of?
No, not yet. It's deep in us. I mean, it's literally in our DNA, the urge to look out for others. When you see someone in need, especially a child or especially someone vulnerable, you feel this intense desire to help them. And it's just there. It's just a feeling. And on the back of that, you know, beautiful moral systems have been built. But it needs nurturing, I would say. Like in its rawest form, it's just a feeling for in-groups, for example. And you don't want a world where people are only looking out for their in-group. You want a world where we all look out for each other. We put some value on all human life. And that may take nurturing. It may take, the good news is that the difference between our in-groups and out-groups is malleable. It's not like set in evolution that you will only care about and love the people you grew up with. Not so. You can form empathy with anyone whose story you can sense. If you hear someone's story, you know, you watch a movie about someone who's completely different from you, you really care about them. That's how we roll. And that's why I thought for a long time that the internet was going to be this amazing force for good in drawing people together, because you could see people on the other side of the planet. You could learn about them, learn their story, put yourself into their shoes. There's huge promise in that. And there still is. It's just that the internet brought a lot of other stuff with it too.
And that's exacerbated in versus out group, right?
Well, I think so. I think one of our evolutionary features, which is now, I think, more a bug than a feature, is that we are hotwired to respond to threats and to fear and to anger. Obvious evolutionary reasons why that might be so. But we're not now living in a world where there's a tiger lurking around every tree. And so it's really unfortunate that we have these social media algorithms that notice that the people who trumpet threats are the ones who get the most clicks, likes, and oh yeah. So someone who can frame the world as a threatening one where these awful people are out there, they're going to ruin your future and you better do something about it, they get support. And so they get amplified. And so we divide ourselves into tribes, and it's dangerous. It really is dangerous. We need, I mean, the motivation for this book, as much as anything, is to try to figure out countermeasures. How do you make the good stuff go viral that will persuade people not to just assume that everything is a threat, and to give people on the other side a different framing? Maybe this is someone I could learn something from. Maybe this is someone I could build something with. If we could shift to that mindset, a lot changes.
Will you tell the story about the two very different people who came together and learned that their differences weren't so different? I'm speaking of the African-American man and the KKK member.
Right. So Darryl Davis, African-American musician, was puzzled why so many people in America didn't like him because of the color of his skin, and went on a curiosity journey to find out more. And he actually invited the local leader of the Ku Klux Klan to a meeting. This was a very tense meeting, it turned out. The KKK guy did not know that the man he was meeting was black. They sat in a hotel room. At one point, some ice clinked and they both leapt to their feet thinking someone had drawn a gun. But they met again. They kind of became friends. Darryl Davis went to KKK rallies and eventually persuaded this guy to leave the KKK, and dozens other followed. And his story was reported and picked up and was heard by millions of people. CNN picked it up. Others did. He had a TEDx talk that was seen by millions of people. And so this for me is part of the playbook. I mean, there's several things from this. One, just how amazing it is and how important a form of generosity it is to bridge, to do that. Two, how powerful courage is. Darryl Davis is an unbelievably courageous man. Most people would not have done this. And it was that courage that made this story go viral. And so courage is one of the key ingredients to breaking the sort of breaking through the noise and saying, wow, this is really something.
Let's talk about the different types of generosity there are, because at first, you know, you think generosity is like, oh, this guy's going to tell me to give away more money, but I don't want to listen to this. But let's start with money and then work our way into the other ways that society needs us to be generous. First of all, there's cash and there's philanthropy and there's needs out there that we maybe minimize that, you know, we could all be giving more for the most part. What's the first step in deciding how we can give the best and the most we can?
So I think the key move is to flip from instinctive, in the moment, sort of guilt-based giving to reflective giving, strategic giving, if you like. So many of us, you know, you see something moving on TV or there's a disaster and you feel like you need to text your money or a friend is in need and so you write them a check. Money, there is such a difference between different orgs and the impact that they can have. And I think it's a much better world if those of us who can give financially just spend the time to find the orgs that are really effective in using that money. And I get really excited when I think about, if you can flip the feeling about cash donations from one of sort of guilt and need to one of exciting possibility, that I think is psychologically what makes a huge difference. I think of social entrepreneurs who run nonprofits as entrepreneurs. I love entrepreneurs of all kinds. I think they are the shapers of history like no one else. I think it's absolutely incredible that someone can have a dream and persuade other people to get excited about that dream and raise money and then build something great and maybe solve a problem. And whether you do that through building a product that has a margin on it, or you do that by focusing on system change and having to raise money through the philanthropic route, you're still an entrepreneur. And the trouble is that the people who go that second route have a horrible time raising money. It's really not fair what we make them do. We literally ask the people most willing to give their lives, if you like, to something bigger than themselves. Okay, you do that. And by the way, please would you spend half of that time raising money? Yeah. What a waste. It's a systemic waste. So if the more of us who can be thoughtful about this and support people who are genuine heroes and help them spend less time raising money and more time actually doing the great stuff, the better things will be. And I think there's a lot of joy in finding a community that's supporting one particular group and getting to know them. And then you yourself, you and that group are part of this. So it's not just a check. It's a communal effort and it feels fantastic.
Would you give me an example of that, how that might come to fruition?
I mean, look, I'm married to an incredible world changer, Jacqueline Novogratz, who has an organization called Acumen that invests in actually in business entrepreneurs, but who are building businesses that won't be invested in by a regular market because they take too long to build a business that's going to serve products like, you know, health or solar power or clean water into villages at the end of long dusty roads. These are very difficult businesses to build. It takes patient capital over many years. But when they're built, they're a much better solution than aid because you've changed the system. You've created a thriving marketplace where needs are being delivered effectively. So she has attracted around her this community of people who are so excited by that vision. We gather regularly. When I meet this group of people, it's just happy making. Honestly, it feels like here is a beautiful counter narrative to the usual thing we hear about. And obviously I'm biased. I'm married to her. I think her work's incredible. There's so many other heroes out there in the world building extraordinary organizations that are dying for the support of someone who has both money and thoughtfulness and connections. Wow, that's getting involved with something like that is really beautiful.
So as opposed to the obligation of giving away a certain percentage of your income, you start to think of part of who I am is that I'm an enabler of opportunity for disadvantaged people, for example, or I'm a person who relieves suffering in these capacities, that kind of thing. Like make it a part of who you are.
100%. To try and apply some of the same thinking that gets us so excited about, you know, the business world. When you see someone's business dream come true, you know, that is a thrilling and amazing thing. I mean, I never thought I was going to be an entrepreneur. I became an entrepreneur. It was incredibly exciting to see that that could happen. But yeah, to apply that same thinking to other people, that there are dreams that we can make come true, that the problems that there are in the world are not, it's not written anywhere that those problems have to last forever. They can be tackled, and the people who are tackling them are incredible, and you could be part of that journey. That is a very, very, very satisfying thing to do.
Now, we were talking about different ways to be generous. So it's not just pulling out your checkbook, and not everybody has a checkbook to pull out. So what are some other ways we can improve the world through different kinds of generosity?
So many. Gifts of knowledge, gifts of creativity. In this connected world, it's so miraculous that you can post something and it can be received by potentially millions of people for a total distribution cost to you of $0. This has never been possible before in history, and it's a complete game changer. So anything that can be shared on the internet can become a gift of unlimited reach. So there's that. The sharing of your network with people. It's so interesting, you know, every act of generosity is, in a sense, asymmetric. It's easier for the giver to give than the value that the receiver gets. So sharing your network is a classic case in point. It might take you 10 minutes to write an email to say, hey, dear friend, I met this person. They would love to know you because of this work that you're doing. Can I introduce you? That may take you 10 minutes. You can change both of those people's lives from that. And so 10 minutes to you, a life changed. Wow. Hospitality, I think, is a beautiful gift. I mean, there's maybe a bit of money involved there because you have to pay for a meal. But basically, humans gathering together to break bread together, drink together, talk together, many of the deepest human connections are formed like this. And I think there's a lot more we could do with it. Jacqueline and I love hosting these one conversation dinners where you group invite, say, six or eight friends around.
Jeffersonian dinners.
Sort of just chit chat. Yeah, you have a one conversation, yeah. And you know, you ask people what their dreams are or what they think is happening in the community that matters. Are there people who maybe could be supported, and you can end up with a group of people getting behind someone, doing it as a group where it's much easier and much more enjoyable. So I think that's honestly a beautiful one as well. It all starts from the fundamental gift is a generous mindset. So it's the willingness to shift attention to someone else or something else. And it's surprisingly hard to do. It's because we spend most of our lives in what Danny Kahneman calls system one thinking mode. You know, we're basically acting instinctively, going through a day, we're in a routine. To actually move out of it and look at someone else and pay attention to their needs is quite hard to do. And it takes an act of reflective attention shift to do it. But all generosity basically starts there. It's the willingness to make that move. And it's actually powerful. Like I was just on, recorded a session on The View this morning, and I did something that they'd never done before in their digital sort of world there. Engage the audience.
Yeah.
I had the audience turn and look at each other. Pick one person, look at them for 15 seconds in silence. Just look at them. And it feels
super awkward.
It's hard work and it feels uncomfortable. The television cameras will look at this and people, you know, that were shedding a tear and so forth. And at the end of that, if you ask the question, hey, is there anything you need? All bets are off about what happens next, because you're in a different mode, they're in a different mode. Anything can happen then.
This is really about consciousness. And you give a framework for trying to figure out, this one caught me, it made me think, and I felt a little guilty for a second. But it was, the question is, are you a net giver or a net taker for the world? And I was like, oh shit, I don't know, man. I mean, like, how do you think about that? Like, how do you create a construct where I go, okay, this is what I am, and this is who I want to be, and this is the pathway to get there?
I mean, the first thing to say is just, to me, there is power in that, in terms of if we are fundamentally a non-selfish spirit. species, we're going to be okay. Like if on average people are net givers, not net takers, we're going to be okay. And what that question recognizes is that the world is complex and muddied and no one can lead a perfect life. And no one should be bogged down by the fact that, you know, you buy some product in a supermarket and then you go, oh my God, was I supporting an exploitative supply chain or whatever? We're not going to live perfect lives, but we can aspire to lead net positive lives. And so I think it's worth just going through almost like a health check and audit of yourself every so often, maybe once a year, and look at the main things in your life. I mean, work is probably number one thing. Am I doing work that is meaningful? Am I giving more to the world than not? You poor, I can confidently say, are giving more to the world than not, because you're spending a few hours preparing these sessions and then thousands and thousands of people are listening to them.
Yeah, but I get paid tens of millions of dollars for this. So, you know, it's...
Does it matter if you're paid for it? The question is, you're giving... I mean, ultimately what we have is our time, and you are spending your time expanding the world's distribution of useful knowledge. This is a form, to me, of generosity, of giving, and it's powerful. So you start there, but you can look at everything. You know, your time outside work. Are you spending any time with others? Your financial giving. I put a pretty high bar out there to challenge people who are well off, to say, can you aspire to the traditional religious demands that were asked of people? In the case of Judeo-Christianity, it's 10% of income. In the case of Islam, it's 2.5% of net worth given annually. I think that those of us who are pretty well off could aspire to the higher of those two. Yeah. And if you can do that, you are definitely a net giver.
Right.
Because if people did that, that would raise more than enough philanthropy for all of the world's problems that can actually be tackled via philanthropy. So, and then there are other pieces. You know, if you care about carbon footprint, you could ask, am I a net giver or taker? I think it's, you know, we feel guilty about traveling. Well, why not adopt a policy of, I will double offset my carbon footprint? Offsets are messy and you can't ever be sure, but by doing a double offset, you can be pretty confident you're a net giver. And actually, the more you fly, the more of a giver you will be, because you're going to double offset it. There's a bunch of things that you can do here to just ask yourself in the different aspects of my life, in terms of hospitality, in terms of relationships. Am I giving more than I'm taking? We don't have to be perfect. I find that a lot of us carry almost a sort of unspoken guilt about aspects of our lives. I actually view this exercise as a way of letting go of that guilt, of giving. We need to give ourselves permission not to be perfect.
Mm.
But net giving is great.
You say, yes, we have the capacity for generosity in all of us, and we all do, but we all also live on a continuum, right, of potential. And where we exist on that continuum has to do with the stimuli and context of our lives. So let's talk about the infectious part of generosity. It's in the title. So how does one act of generosity spur on another?
Partly because we have another instinct, which is to respond to generosity. A very powerful instinct. I talk in the book about a new social experiment that was done that really shows that super powerfully, where 200 people were given $10,000, no strings attached. They responded by spending 2/3 of that money generously. It was really delightful and inspiring response. So that instinct is in there. And because we're in the connected age, it's possible for more and more things to spread. So for these gifts, instead of a gift reaching 3 people, it can reach 3 million people potentially. So when you put these pieces together, there's no reason why we shouldn't be in a world where we are collectively inspiring each other to pass it on, spread kindness. The fact that generosity is asymmetric, that it is, if you can find your way of giving, it is easier for you to do that. The benefit to others will be greater. A world in which generosity spreads is a world where all boats rise. All boats rise. I mean, that's the argument for it. And it feels that close, that we, like the infrastructure to do this is in place. It's all there. And you're right that everyone's in a different situation, but I think everyone can find their way to give, a way that is actually more joyful than it is hard. I think that is doable. And if we can do that, I can get excited.
All right. One of the ways we are more likely to give is if we recognize how fortunate we are. So let's take a gratitude break. What are you grateful for today?
Well, I'm pretty grateful to be having this conversation right now. I mean, it's just amazing what makes this possible. The fact that I can sit at home, talk to you, you can forward this to thousands of others. It's just, that is so cool. That's something possible at any other time in history. Talking like this has always been part of human superpower, that we can exchange words and shape each other's emotions and give each other ideas. All that is wild. But the fact that we can do it at scale now is just incredible. In so many other things, you know, just, I think it's actually a beautifully healthy practice every morning to think of just one thing. And it can be the obvious things like the loved ones in your life, or just the non-obvious things that we forget. We get so accustomed to it, of living in the modern world and being able to turn on a tap and have a glass of clean drinking water, or have electric sockets everywhere that we can plug devices into that warm us and cool us to the right temperature and clean our houses and our dishes. And it's an amazing world that we live in, and it's very, very easy to forget it. But when you remember it, you kind of feel, okay, that's good. The universe has been kind to me. I'm glad I was born when I was. Now what can I do?
Right. I wouldn't want to be in some dank castle in the middle of medieval Germany somewhere.
I mean, can you imagine? I mean, literally everyone listening to this has won the lottery of humanity. Like 99% plus of humans who were ever born lived fairly short, scary lives with lots of disease, lots of predators, a lot of fear. We're unbelievably lucky.
I agree. And one of the rewards of reading your book is to remind yourself how good we have it, if nothing else. And so hopefully I'll act on the good feeling if, you know, depending upon how long it lasts. I want to spend the few more minutes we have left talking about the power of media, because we see generosity, philanthropy, and ideas integrated with the power of technology and media. One of the things that I find myself both fascinated with and repulsed by is performative philanthropy. And it depends on the, for me personally, this is my point of view, not fact, so I just want to put it that way. But I find Mr. Beast to be interesting, fascinating from a generational standpoint. I look at it and watch my son watching these videos of this guy who has a bigger reach than all the television networks put together. And he's built this up through acts of goodwill. I see other people on Instagram filming videos of themselves giving $100 to a homeless person, and my stomach turns. Now, I know that homeless person needs that money, but it doesn't feel right to me. Can you help me sort through my feelings, please?
I mean, I think the feelings are completely understandable, first of all. We've all been brought up to think of generosity as something that you do anonymously, and that we want our motives to be as pure as possible, and that means you don't tell anyone because that could just mean that you're boasting. I've come to believe that in this connected age, we need to let some of that go. Partly because I feel like we're in this existential battle between bad acts and good acts online. And I think if the people who do the good things are completely silent about them, we're handing over victory to those who want to boast about the drama they've stirred up or the anger they've stirred up. I think there are ways that you can share your story, the way that you can share stories of kindness that are beautiful. I agree that there are exploitative kindness videos. And I think one of the key tests is, how does the person who received the quote act of kindness feel about it? I mentioned the book, you know, a video of, you know, a woman who was given flowers and filmed and she cried and this video went viral. She was upset by it. She felt exploited by it. And I think that's not generosity and not cool. In most of Mr. Beast's videos, the recipients do not feel that way. I think they are delighted to have, for example, had cataract surgery and been given their eyesight back. And I think the fact that he's quite loud about it, hey, look what this happened, you know, look what I did, is, I think it's okay that this is part of the culture coming through, because I think there's a generation coming through that genuinely believes that kindness is cool.
Yeah.
And I think if people believe that, and these videos spread, it's going to make a better world. I think the key questions to ask are, what is the main intent here? If someone is just clearly doing it for the views and there isn't any respect for the recipient, not happy with it. In Mr. Beast's case, many people in our generation, my generation, I'm older than you, are uncomfortable with just the style and the brashness of it. But I've spoken to, for example, the person who runs his philanthropy and to other people close to him. I'm persuaded he's the real deal. He is determined to use his platform for good in the world. And he has inspired millions and millions of people to think differently about charity, kindness, and to imagine. I think the next generation coming through is sick of how mean a world we've dumped on them. Mm. They want a different way. And if the way to get that different way is to show examples online of kind things happening, I'm all in. When all said and done, I'm all in. And I think we can welcome it.
I think Mr. Beast he's different because he's very unpretentious and he's not creepy. I mean, he's having fun. He's got his buddies out there and it's so wild. You know, these guys spend $1 million and they'll get, I don't know, 100 parents, you know, who can sit in a room the longest. And if they do it, they get, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or something. And it's like, who would come up with this? So he gets a pass. So he's doing it well, I guess. I guess, again, there's a continuum of both style and sincerity. And he's in the upper, the good quadrant.
And he's inspired many others. I spoke with this guy, Millard Merg, who works in a sandwich shop. His parents, Syrian immigrants, and he's on TikTok. And he saw this trend on TikTok of food waste, you know, huge quantities of food dumped just to show how much of a disgusting mess you can make in your parents' kitchen. Ha ha. He was disgusted by it and did his own version where he got huge quantities of peanut butter and jelly and bread and handmade sandwiches and wrapped them, took them out into the streets and gave them to people. And this video was seen more than the videos of the trend he was fighting. So one person's generosity turned around a trend. And yeah, it brought him a lot of views and a lot of followers. Well, he told me, he said, what goes viral, there's not symmetry here. Like any emotional thing can go viral. So if you kick someone in the face, that could be a viral video. But if you want to build something that lasts, you have a much better chance of doing it by doing things that are good. Because ultimately people want to support people who are working for something positive. And I found that so exciting that this is perceived wisdom. And I've spoken to a lot of people around his age who kind of feel the same, that they want a world where kindness is rewarded and recognized and they will get behind it. And yeah, it can't be boring. It can't be Sunday school and sort of precious and earnest and whatever. It's got to be playful and fun and cool. So let's go with that. Let's be creative. Let's be courageous. Let's be bold. And those stories have a chance at taking out the ugliness that is otherwise going to choke us.
Now, the dovetail of media and ideas and this book is really what TED is all about, right? That you're spreading knowledge, you're spreading thought. And your slogan, Ideas Worth Spreading, is a powerful one, but it also implies some degree of subjectivity. In our increasingly divided and polarized world, who decides what ideas are worth spreading?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's one that we debate a lot. We think that we can't just be about ideas worth spreading. We have to also be about ideas worth debating. We're at a moment in the world where people are so divided that if you wanted to have complete agreement on, oh yeah, these are ideas worth spreading, you would have to pick one tribe and just belong to them and only do those ideas. And we don't want to be that. We want to be nonpartisan. We want to be for everyone. I mean, ideas are for everyone. And TED's remit is broad. And so that means, and we're increasingly doing this, is bringing in voices that may make some people uncomfortable and have real discussions, even if they're tough. So I think in the future of TED, you'll see a lot more conversations as well as just talks and debates and maybe some controversy, and that's okay. But I think that's what we have to do in the current moment.
What do you think the most important contribution TED has made to the world is?
I mean, maybe it's just the idea that ideas can be shared so easily and that it works. I met this woman a couple of years ago, Supriya Paul, who watched one of the first TED Talks online, Sir Ken Robinson, talking about how education could be made more inspiring for all kids, the big focus on creativity. She was studying to be an accountant at the time. It's what her father wanted. She saw this and it kind of, she and her partner said, we could do this in India. And so she persuaded her father to give her a year to try and raise money. And they did this startup called Josh Talks. And this thing is incredible. I only found out about it a couple of years ago, but it's scaled. They're basically, it's like India's TED Talks. They have a little red rug and they did this without permission. And I'm delighted for it because they have reached, they're reaching like 100 million people monthly now. And these are people outside the normal education system in India. It's like primarily aimed at rural people. They're just sharing knowledge. They're sharing knowledge. And, you know, it's spreading its own incredible ripple effects. So part of me feels if all that TED had done was create Josh Talks, that would be enough. That would be great. India, you know, it's the world's most populous country. It's going to shape the future as much as anything. It's something that is giving knowledge and inspiration to large numbers of people in India. That's great. I think it's so incredible that we're in a world. I mean, more broadly, there are now millions and millions of people who have made it their life's work, whether it's on TikTok or YouTube or Instagram or X or wherever it is, to learn something that matters and share it. And viewed one way, we're therefore living in this sort of torrent of noise. Viewed another way, we're the beneficiaries of an unbelievable amount of generosity pouring at us for free from every direction. And if we carefully pick what we want to absorb, I mean, the gifts that come from that are extraordinary. They've never been available to people before. We're literally entering an era where every human has a shot at discovering their full potential. This is pretty thrilling. And obviously, TED has played one little, you know, drop in that whole movement. It's basically the internet and the connected world. But it's really thrilling to have been part of that.
Well, I really appreciate you doing your best, taking your effort, taking your shot at making the world a better place through your work at TED and the authoring of this book, Infectious Generosity, The Ultimate Idea Worth Spreading. If anything, Chris, it's made me want to be less of an a-hole on social media.
Yes. You know, it's so tempting though, right? Like I've been a complete asshole on social media myself. Back early in the days of Twitter, I had this big following, you know, that grew quickly. And a comedian, I'm not even going to go into the details of this, but a comedian came to TED and I really didn't like what happened and how it went. And so I tweeted, you know I shouldn't say this about one of my own speakers, but I thought this was a disaster. And that was so asshole-y thing to do, even though I thought I was protecting the poor fragile minds of people at TED and so forth. It was a total asshole thing to do. Since then, but several years later, we've met and made up and so forth. But it can make, you know, there's power in having a following. And it's so tempting to create a drama, you know, say something brave and bold and controversial. And the easiest way to do that is to be really nasty to someone else. It's the easiest way to do it. And it's really, really, really dangerous.
Thanks for doing your part, Chris Anderson. Where can our listeners find out more about you?
So, well, I'm on X, at TED Chris. The book itself is at infectiousgenerosity.org. There's a nice AI there, by the way.
Oh, yeah,
called TIG. the Infectious Generosity Guru, which you can access at infectiousgenerosity.org, that will help you like brainstorm your own generosity journey. It's kind of fun. So that's worth possibly checking out. Those would be the main areas.
We'll put links to that in the show notes. Thanks so much for your time. I am grateful for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. This was really fun. I really like how you structure this. Thank you.
Well, that was super fun to talk to Chris. And as I mentioned in the intro, I wish I'd asked him more about his personal life. Maybe we'll have him back to do a deep dive on his journey, because I think it's informative. And I did find it interesting to put TED into context, the organization that is, and as to how it came to be what it is today. Let's jump into some takeaways. I think what we discussed late in the conversation is really, really important. We're in a fascinating space these days where the people who shape public thinking have just an inordinate amount of influence in the way society operates and thinks, from every level, from the schools to corporations to governments. And it's really, really important that we can keep in context how these purveyors of information influence our world. The Google Gemini fiasco is a profound example of what can happen when individuals who dominate the world's flow of information use their political ideas as a layover to what the world can see. This is no better, by the way, than the book banning that we've seen in certain municipalities around the country. But these two extremes demonstrate just how important the influencers are in our world. And Ted is another such influencer. So I'm gratified to hear Chris say that they'll be continuing to offer different points of view to inspire vigorous conversation and advance human learning and understanding in the process. And I look forward to seeing how this comes to fruition over the next months and years. Next, as it relates more to generosity, I think his ideas, Chris's ideas of normalizing and formalizing, yes, that rhymes, got a little Jesse Jackson in there for you today. Normalizing and formalizing the discussion of generosity is a good thing. Normalizing it to say, hey, this is part of who we are. And some of these organizations that he mentioned in the book, like Giving What We Can and others, they normalize and formalize the discussion of generosity as a way not just to improve the world, but to make our lives more meaningful in the process. Lastly, I did find that reading this book was an opportunity for me to remind myself and meditate on all the good things that I have in my life. And I found this gratitude empowering. When you start from a point of view of gratitude, you say, I have all these things in my life that are good. And wouldn't other people be stronger? Wouldn't our world be stronger if other people had that too? So you can't change the entire world, but maybe you can start a tiny little revolution of your own by doing something kind, by sharing some of your gifts with the world today. Check out his book, Infectious Generosity. There's a link to his website, infectiousgenerosity.org, in the show notes. Thanks. We'll see you again real soon.